Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to Free Forum, a world that just might work. I'll be joined today by Randy Olson, marine biologist turned filmmaker, author of Don't Be Such a Scientist and Houston, We Have a Narrative. His narrative index predicted Trump's victory. After hosting and producing this show weekly for 17 years, I stepped away from recording new live interviews. And since then, I've dug into the archives to stream one of the relevant earlier episodes each week on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn. And podcasts of years of interviews are available to listen to anytime, anywhere on iTunes, Podomatic, and at my site, TerrenceMcNally.net, that's TerrenceMcNally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com, they're the same site. But following the election of Donald Trump, I cannot resist exploring the path forward in confronting him and his administration and moving past them to the world we want. First off today, I'm going to offer you a few websites for information on how to actively participate in resistance to Trump and the movement toward the healthy, progressive future we so desperately need. And you can email me at temcnally@mac.com to get these websites and more. Indivisible Guide. Indivisibleguide.com. That's one word. That's probably the most functional, active group. There's like 5,000 chapters all around the country. OurRevolution.com, which is the organization that grew out of the Bernie Sanders campaign. MoveOn.org, which for many years has been doing primarily online organizing, but since the Trump election has begun to align themselves much more closely with grassroots work on the ground. Five Calls, that's the number five and the word calls. Fivecalls.org tells you the most relevant phone calls to your representatives that you need to be making at any time. Townhallproject.com tells you when your local representatives are going to be holding town halls so you can let your voice be heard. And Courage Campaign, one word, .org, active in California, been around for a long time, but like Move On, beginning to align its online activism more closely with grassroots work on the ground. And as I said, you can email me at temcnally@mac.com if you want more information on resistance to the Trump administration. These are strange times for our relationship to science. We rely on the latest technologies for more and more of our experience, our consciousness, our relationships, our work. And to some extent, this is so now of rural as well as urban dwellers. Now, it may be more true among the young in many areas of life, but in medicine, for example, it's likely most true for seniors and the aged. Yet at the same time, a significant segment of American society will admit to, or in fact proudly claim, that they have an adversarial relationship with science. Millions who trust science with their lives numerous times on a daily basis will tell you they don't trust science. What does that mean, and does it matter? Well, as long as they buy in their daily lives, isn't that the bottom line? No. Because science that warns us about the likely future consequences of our actions, that's what they find suspect. That's the science they don't trust. And that leaves them susceptible to a message that means things don't need to change, sold to them by those who profit in the short term from delaying our response to science's warnings. Today's guest, Randy Olson, says this is a new time. Age-old rhythms have broken down. We're all receiving a fire hose of information. We no longer can deal with separate bits of information, so we look for higher levels of organization. We look for narratives. He says scientists are lousy communicators, and we can't afford that. He's got an interesting theory of why scientists don't understand media, and he's actively working to change it. Olson earned his PhD in biology from Harvard and was a tenured professor of marine biology at the University of New Hampshire when he quit all that and moved to Los Angeles to attend USC Film School to learn narrative and bring that knowledge back to his fellow scientists. He's written and directed a number of short films and feature documentaries, written a couple of books, Don't Be Such a Scientist and Houston, We Have a Narrative, and he's developed Story Circles, a system where folks learn and practice seeing and speaking in narrative. Old industries and old prejudices that don't want to change use narrative to attract and influence a willing audience who also don't want to change. And we need to come up with narratives that change the perspective of enough people to speed things up, just to reduce the friction that slows down our pursuit and our adoption of solutions. Welcome, Randy Olson, to Free Forum, a world that just might work.
That is the best introduction anybody's ever given for me. I think we're all done with figuring out who I am. Thanks.
Very good, man. So I laid out that story there of this marine biologist who throws it all away to go to Hollywood. But can you tell us, in your own words, your path to the work you're doing today? And feel free to go back to some early moments, some turning point, a mentor, a moment of decision, that kind of thing.
Geeminis. it's a long story. But in a nutshell, I was a tenured professor of marine biology, and I love doing science, but I developed this bigger, broader interest in mass communication. And you know what? You mentioned in your last episode, Neil Postman's book, Amusing Ourselves to Death. That is such an important book. I read that just before I really jumped ship and left my tenured professorship and went to film school at USC in 1994. And that kind of is a lot of where my interests, my big picture interests are in, is this fascination with media and the changing landscape. And I think, you know, I have a background in evolutionary ecology. That was what I studied at Harvard back when I was a scientist. And when you look at the world through the perspective of natural selection and the basic ideas that Darwin sketched out and the evolutionists over the years have really kind of filled in the picture on, you see the world a little bit differently. And in fact, my colleague right now, Jade Lovell, who's my Story Circles training program co-creator, she and I have been slowly working on this whole perspective that we call narrative selection. And is the idea, it's what's going on in social media. There is the same thing as natural selection, the way in which species all produce large numbers, and then the environment goes to work selecting the ones that have got the proper sort of genetic makeup. The same thing happens with social media, and it's going on all the time right now. It's going on with Twitter in particular. There is narrative selection. There's an environment out there that selects for narrative. We're programmed for narrative, and it will continue to go on.
Wait a minute. You're saying that in 140 character blasts, still, A, people can put out narrative, and B, people can see the difference and feel the difference.
No. What I'm saying is that narrative selection is going on. So one of the things that we'll talk a lot about this, you know, the core discovery that I feel I've made is this simple little template of and but therefore. I derived it from the South Park guys, but they clearly must have picked it up from people such as Frank Danielle in the 1980s, great screenwriting instructor. But it's the idea of this universal narrative template, this structure around three forces: agreement, contradiction, and consequence. And the most common words to capture that are and, but, and therefore, or so. So we see it all over the place. And from that perspective, you know, that's what shapes our world. And so we, in our workshops over the last few years, one of the things we do is we have the people come up with their one sentence statement using the ABT, we call it, that's the shorthand, and but therefore, and they send them in before they even get there. And I began counting the number of characters. And this is basically telling, there's somebody telling their story without any coaching at all, off the top of their head. This is what people need in order to tell that. And it turns out it was averaged around 280 characters. That's what you need to tell a full narrative. Now we take a look at Twitter, and it's only 140 characters. And there you see the problem. It is not a narrative medium, and you can see narrative selection going on every day. You see Twitter having problems now. They're saying, we're going to try and expand it, make more room for the larger tweets. And furthermore, Jade has got data. She used to work for the world's biggest PR firm, Weber Shandwick, and they did a study there on Facebook posts. And they found an optimum there that was somewhere in that same range, around 250 to 300 characters. When you got lower than that, it just, there's not enough depth to it to have any impact. Now we take a look at El Presidente and what he is doing using this non-narrative medium for diplomacy. And I have been trying to do blog posts on this for the past year and a half. Why in the world would you allow the most important diplomatic voice of your entire nation to use this non-narrative medium that doesn't set up any context? There's not enough room there. And you need these three things to communicate effectively: agreement, contradiction, and consequence. Before we cut to the chase, go right to the program or to the problem, we need to begin with what can we agree on here? And he doesn't do any of that. So it's just so much noise of what he's doing there. And it's just sad that the opponents don't have the ability to stand up and say, that's not right. We got to draw a line. But they're not.
Well, but wait. I mean, I would say, yes. You know, whoever, quote, the opponents are, a lot of them are saying that. There were people who, there were bills in Congress that have
limiting the president's ability to use Twitter?
Yes. In other words, I have certainly seen representatives who have put that forward. Now,
yeah.
You're saying, why aren't they saying something about it? They are. Doing something about it
yes.
is a big difference, and I don't expect that to happen.
Yeah. Well, it should.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, but in whose authority? Is it Twitter's authority? Is it the Congress's? I mean, whose authority?
The Congress ought to rise up and say, look, we've had a change in the environment, and you've got to change how your government works in relation to that environment. And Obama used Twitter, but he was a conscientious guy, and he used it just for lighthearted sorts of things. Suddenly, we've got this guy in there that's now using it as a tool of diplomacy. And why can't you change the rules for the president as the environment changes? That's the updating process, but
okay.
It's not happening.
Okay, I see what you're saying. And, of course, just as with impeachment and so many other things, the reason that nothing will be done about that is because the party that hopes to gain by his presence in the office is the only one that has the power really to do that. One big thing you say, and I want you to sort of...
Take me to task, please.
Well, no, this is a...
Yes, on everything.
This is a contextual question. You say, if you don't tell your story,
yes.
somebody else will. Now, I'm going to say two things about that. One, that obviously applies not just to scientists and not just to important things. It applies to you and your children, you and your partners, you and your team, and so on. And what do you really mean by that?
Precisely that, because we're in this noise-filled society now. Everybody is just communicating too much. You know, we're super saturated. And people used to be able to have a little bit more time to actually listen and be a little more thoughtful. Now it's just the information fire hose. And it means, again, there's narrative selection. There is selection for those who have got this ability to use these three forces of agreement, contradiction, and consequence most skillfully. And tragically, as you know, at the biggest scale of all, we saw in this last election, one candidate who, God, you know, she had a book, Takes a Village. What happened with her campaign staff that they couldn't do something with that to create a narrative for her? But this is a tragedy that the Democratic Party was so lacking themselves in narrative instincts and intuition to get behind a candidate who had no message. And she was on Meet the Press in August 2016, and Chuck Todd said, what's the one core thing at the center of this whole campaign of yours? And she just chuckled and said, oh, Chuck, there's no one thing. You know, we stand for a whole bunch of things. That's not politics. That's not communication. That's not messaging. It's not narrative. You cannot expect to win the presidency with that. In contrast, her opponent continues to have deep narrative intuition. I wrote an editorial, tried for a year to get published, warning everybody, this guy has got, this is straight out of Neil Postman's book, as you were saying last time. I mean, why didn't any of these pundits, all of these brainiacs that dominate, you know, the intelligentsia, whatever, why didn't any of them see that coming and warn about this? Why didn't anybody sound alarms when Chris Matthews was preempting MSNBC night after night to let this guy give full speeches? No candidate ever in the history of this country has been given that amount of airtime. What was going on? Neil Postman could have told you, you know, verbatim, easily, as well as Michael Crichton. He also gave speeches that identified this.
Yeah, we'll give
power.
You a chance to talk about that Crichton talk you find so influential from 1999.
As Crichton. Crichton is a yeah. type of snail,
Crichton
is a writer.
Did I say Crichton?
No, that's what I heard.
I certainly meant Crichton. By the way, I actually acted in his movie Looker.
Really?
Yes.
So, awesome.
So I have a past with Michael Crichton.
Excellent.
But when you what you said here about why didn't the pundits, why didn't they? And I think what they don't want to admit, but I think it's that they really didn't realize the size of the threat. They didn't realize that he wasn't just going to be a big story, that he wasn't just going to be big ratings for them, but that he was going to win. And many of them have said that if you looked back, they went, well, if we'd known how it was going to turn out. But of course, in a story, you never know how it's going to turn out. That's why it's a good story. If we'd known how it was going to turn out, we wouldn't have given them all that free time. But their underestimation plays to what you said, which was the reason they were able to underestimate his likelihood of success was that they underestimated the value and power of narrative. I will share with you, Randy, I'm watching the first debate with my wife, sitting on the couch, just the two of us, and even though he wasn't great the whole hour and a half, after about 20 minutes, I turned to her and I said, we are in trouble. He is a narrative machine.
Yep.
Now, you, I hadn't seen it so much from catching him occasionally over the years, but when you watch, his whole thing was big narratives about America, about losing, about pain, about, all of this stuff that it was everything he said was wrapped in a narrative. Every time, even if she had a narrative, she skipped it and went straight to the policy and the ideas. And from that moment on, this is first debate, I began to think he was going to win, that unless something big happened, narrative would trump, as it were, policy as it did.
And now I'm going to take you to task for something you said in the last episode. Maybe we'll have a little argument here. Maybe I'll offend a bunch of your listeners. So at the end of the last episode, which was really tremendous,
I thought. That was with John Nichols. It was seemingly about his book, Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse, but really it was about issues that Nichols has been working on for years, the media, voting rights, and so on. And we sort of kind of looked at all of that and what it meant. But this moment that you're going to take me to task for,
yeah,
is...
Absolutely. So you got to the end, you said, and I want to tell the Democratic Party, and here's what you said verbatim, you got to tell a better story. We need a story that is more exciting than the yearning for the past. So let's talk about what narrative is made of. Three forces: agreement, contradiction, and consequence. There is no emotion in the future. The future is intellectual. The future cannot be used to try and motivate the masses. The tool that we have to use to motivate the masses is the past. That is fundamental and baked into this narrative process that's at least 4,000 years old. Agreement, contradiction, and consequence. We can't agree on anything for the future. We hopefully can agree on lots of things from the past. That's one of the constraints. So the idea of reaching into the past, as he did, is actually powerful in narrative terms. And when you start to look at some of the great orators of this country, they began their greatest speeches beginning in the past. Lincoln began with 80 and yada, yada. King, almost 100 years later, began his I Have a Dream speech the same way, talking about 80, connecting himself into the past with Lincoln. And so Trump, with this template that he used of Make America Great Again, that was not some cockamamie silly little thing that he thought up spur of the moment. That arose from the depths of his narrative intuition, and you can trace it back 4,000 years. You can trace it right to Joseph Campbell and the hero's journey. Why none of these pundits gave any sort of perspective on that in terms of analyzing his rhetoric, I do not understand.
Well, but wait a second. Martin Luther King Jr. begins in the past.
Yes.
But the speech is, I have a dream. It is a dream of the future. What ends up taking those people not just from leaning in and caring about what he says, but actually getting roused up that they might do something, is the dream of the future. That's what I'm saying the Democrats have to do. I'm not saying you start in the future.
Wait, let's stay right there with that, because the emotion he was tapping into was the past. And the future has no emotion. One of the things they told us in film school a number of times, don't put dream sequences into your movie. Why would you do that? There's nothing emotional about a dream sequence. That's events that never really happened. If you want to have a movie that's going to have real, genuine human connection and emotion, it's got to be things that we understand from experience. The future is intellectual. The past is experiential. We draw emotion out of experiences, not out of projecting into the future. This is one of the challenges the whole climate movement faces. You're trying to get us riled up about projections from the future. It's a massive challenge.
Golly, I'm going to read you a quote.
Sorry. Let me get one last obnoxious thing to put in there.
Good.
Therefore, this thing called MoveOn.org is the worst idea ever. And this is the problem with the whole Democratic Party. This is a fundamental fatal flaw that it's suffering from right now, is the unwillingness to examine the past. And I think it arises out of this principle of non-judgmentalism, this idea of let's not point fingers of a blame, let's not be judgmental about who did things wrong. Okay. I have witnessed this in the environmental movement with the foundations who waste gargantuan amounts of money and are unwilling to talk about the mistakes that they made. It's just, let's move on. Let's go to the next thing. Let's not dwell on the past. And now we've got this book from Hillary in the last 2 weeks that's tragic. The best thing she could have done for this country was bring in 5 experts, let them assess what went on with their campaign, and then offer her commentary on that. But instead, they just have not engaged in anything. They don't want to look at the past and learn from it. And then that all leads back to the famous thing about people who don't learn from the past are destined to just keep on repeating it. And that's what you see from the left. And it's getting really bad now. And I think it's a fundamental flaw handicapping them, along with the other one, which is the inclusiveness problem. And that's a whole separate little thing we can get into. So keep going.
Yeah.
All right. Now I'll let you go. Yeah. Sorry.
On the inclusiveness piece, Bannon would love to sit here and chime in on that one. As you know, he says, as long as the Democrats are focused on inclusion and diversity, we win. And I think he's right. But let me.
One last thing on that. From the New York Times, January 19th, they said in an editorial, Democrats have been sidetracked by trying to accommodate the various needs of a diverse America and thus have failed to promote a unifying narrative. That's the New York Times saying what you're saying Bannon is saying. So,
yeah. Okay, no. I. Now, it's, tell you what, we can go on a little digression, Randy, since it looks like that's what we're going to do anyway. The Bannon-Charlie Rose interview, you saw it?
Yes.
Now, what I saw after that, for the most part, was people saying, oh, this was horrible, he was terrible, he shouldn't have been on, and so on. I looked at it, and I thought, he won that interview, no question. That Rose was, and I've been meaning to write on this and just haven't yet, because I've been doing other stuff, but Rose was had a set of talking points that he felt so justified his emotions that Bannon would be, you know, flustered and have any respond to it, whereas Bannon had narratives and stories and that were clear and solid. And so while you might know that some of what he was saying wasn't exactly accurate, wasn't here, there some percentage of people might go, oh, wait a minute. I think for the most part, and I'll tell you this is the other crazy thing, I agreed with about 70% of what he said.
So you're a Republican.
Bannon. Well, you know what I'm saying, though.
Yes.
It was it when in his final line.
Yeah.
This is the Bannon-Rose interview on 60 Minutes. He says, this is the part that wasn't in the overtime. The overtime had some great stuff, too. But he said, there's a populist revolution. It's either going to be a left populist revolution or a right populist revolution, but this is what's coming. And I believe he's right.
And you remember he kept saying, I'm a street fighter, I'm a fighter, I'm a fighter, and narrative. Those go hand in hand. That's what it's about. You know, you need to be a fighter, and the thing you need to fight with is narrative. So, yeah.
Also, even when you say I'm a street fighter, one of the things that I talk about when I deal with clients about story is when you can't tell a whole story, use the elements of story. So when you just say I'm a street fighter, people know the story. They have a picture of whether it's a kid or a type of person. They know what the attitudes are. They know what the moods are. You have bought them into a character right then with that one phrase that basically plays on their addiction to narrative. With what you said about, I find what you say about the future kind of scary because I think what we do need is for people to feel something worth moving toward. This is a quote from Antoine de Saint-Exupéry, wrote The Little Prince, storyteller. He says, if you want to build a ship, don't drum up the men to gather wood, divide the work, and give orders. Instead, teach them to yearn for the vast and endless sea.
Wait. Can you say that again slowly?
Yes. If you want to build a ship, don't drum up the men to gather wood, divide the work, and give orders. Instead, teach them to yearn for the vast and endless sea. Okay? Now, what I see him saying there is give people something they're yearning for, something that pulls them forward, all that other stuff will take care of itself. To me, that is what I feel progressives, Democrats, etc., have to do. They have to create something that people yearn for more than going back to the past. Does that, how does that fit into what you're saying about the future cannot move people?
Well, I think what you're hitting on with that quote right there is that it's all about emotion. It's not about intellectualism. And this is the challenge that we face, which is the intellectuals are a very valuable resource, and they give us a lot of information, but don't put them in charge. And this has been the problem with the climate movement. It's been heavily scientific, heavily science-driven, and they brought in lots of intellectuals, and they don't have a clue. You reach the masses through emotion, and you've got to, that's what my first book was about. Don't be such a scientist. You've got to come down out of your head into these lower organs to reach people, to motivate them. And I know it's great to paint these pictures of the future, but nobody's connecting with that. You've got to use the past. This stuff's not easy, you know, and you cannot come together in 3 months and come up with a powerful motivational message the way that they did with the Al Gore movie. They tried to do. And I'm sorry, I've spent a lot of time critiquing that, and
which one are you talking about? The first one, or the second
Inconvenient
one?
Truth.
The first one.
Yeah, the first one, exactly. And you know, the intentions were noble, but it's not that simple. So what happened was the summer of 2005. I'm sure you were here at environmental events that summer. I was all through Hollywood, and people were saying there were 5 hurricanes summer of 2005, and the word started to go out. This is it. Global warming's here. We are now in a world that every summer we're going to have this many hurricanes, and people panicked. And Laurie David, the producer, said it's time to make a movie urgently. And she was involved with another movie called Too Hot Not to Handle for HBO. I know scientists that were a part of the advisors on that. And they basically said she came to us and more or less, you know, figuratively speaking, said, I want to thank you for your work on this 3 or 4 year project that's moving along slowly, diligently. But now we've got a crisis and we've just got to make this thing really quickly. By that fall, they filmed it at Sunset Gower Studios. I have friends who were in the audience there. And that next spring, they came out with it. They did not incubate a narrative for that. They did not consider all these principles that are very difficult. If you want to warn people about the future, you can't just paint a picture of the future and expect people to, oh, we get it. It's not that simple. It's a real tough challenge. You've got to tap into narrative. There were stories that could have been told that would have been three-act structured narrative that would have reached emotionally inside of people. But you can't expect to do that in just 3 or 4 months. As a result, they produced what I call an and presentation. They had Al Gore get up there. The best of intentions. Great guy, Al Gore. You know, admirable. But it was a film that played to the choir. And 10 years later is largely unwatchable. You know, I go to college campuses and say to the students, who wants to get together at night and have beer and pizza and watch the Al Gore movie? And they go, oh, no, God. Sorry. But it's just not that easy. And more importantly is, why didn't they learn from that? So the summer of 2010, year after my first book, Don't Be Such a Scientist, came out, somebody made the mistake of inviting me to this conference, one-day workshop in Washington, D.C. called 60 Great Thinkers on the Climate. And I sat there for the whole day listening to them. I wasn't allowed to be one of the speakers, but at the end, they gave me the microphone, the final comments. And I said, I cannot believe I've sat here for the whole day. I mean, the whole thing was cued by, that was the end of really the efforts in Congress to try and create some climate legislation. The last bill had collapsed miserably, and they were trying to do somewhat of a behind closed doors postmortem. But no one talked about Al Gore for the entire day. And that's what I said. How can you do this thing all day? And the only common ground we've got for communication on climate is this movie that was made in 2006. And for better or worse, you know, it did some good things, had some problems. Why wasn't that the centerpiece of discussion? And when I finished my comments, the woman who was the head of his organization pulled me aside and thanked me for saying that, because she said, ever since the movie didn't pull off miracles, the foundations have basically ostracized Al. They won't talk to him anymore. They say, you gave it your shot. You're done. We need to move on and do something different. There's your problem. Why don't you slow down and do some assessment? And guess what the Republicans did, you know, for better, for cockamamie or whatever. But when they lost Obama in 2012, they did their Bobby Jindal-led postmortem thing where they try, you know, of course, they ended up with Trump. They didn't listen to anything he said from that. But at least they've got that in their programming. I think this is a fundamental, really bad flaw, this idea of moving on and just throwing everything in the past. They're not learning anything. They're on a treadmill like gerbils, just running as fast as they can, doing stuff that's not amounting to anything.
So you said when I read you the Saint-Exupéry quote, you said what he's right about there is it's about emotion,
yeah,
not intellectualism. And did I read a critique or see you critique the two Leonardo DiCaprio environmental films as well?
Yep.
That's The 11th Hour and
The One Last Fall that he had, yeah, on which, National Geographic.
Yeah, yeah. I'm forgetting that.
Right.
Too Hot to, I don't even know, but okay.
Too Hot to Watch.
Yes, it's in my TiVo queue, I promise. Before the Flood, that's what it was. But you said the problem is it's all fear.
So first off, Roger Ebert, reviewing 11th Hour, said, despite its noble intentions, the movie is a bore. And I forgot the quote I pulled out from The Hollywood Reporter,
yeah,
I think,
but
last
also
fall.
Also said noble.
Also used the word noble. And that's exactly right. You know, Leo's got really noble intentions, and it's great. The problem is he's just not getting people to work with him that are managing to craft these narratives. This stuff is really, really tough. There is a movie out right now that's about coral reef conservation, the death of coral reefs. It is not narratively structured very well. I got asked to be on a post-screening panel of it, and I just said, you don't want me there. You know, everybody's going to have fun, and I'm going to chew it all up. But a week later, HBO Real Sports, who are masters of narrative, came out with a segment on the Great Barrier Reef. And it was so good, I transcribed the whole thing. I wrote a lengthy blog post, broke it down 3-act structure, pointed out all of the different elements of narrative. This is really a textbook case of how you use narrative. And a week later, the producer sent me a nice email, and he and I had an hour-long phone call. He's a great guy, Chapman Downs. And he revealed the secret to their success, which is they've been around since 95. They've got 3 or 4 producers there who've been there for 15 years or more. They have deep narrative intuition. That's what this stuff is all about. That's the term that I coined in my book, narrative intuition. It's not about, you know, learning a few rules. It's about working with this stuff, as Malcolm Gladwell says, for more than 10,000 hours so that you can see it and feel it and shape it. And that is what Trump has got in spades.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That's the problem.
Yeah. To go back to one thing you said there about, mentioning ESPN and sports. It is my belief, and it has been a long time, that sports is the best writing in newspapers. And the reason I say that is if you play 162 games of baseball, 82 games of basketball, et cetera, they're the same. The score is easy. Seven to five, six to two, whatever it is. And so what that writer has to do is he has to find a story with characters and arcs for every
game. That's a very good point. And look at the sample size.
It's that it's the first time he's facing his former team.
Yes, yes.
He's facing the guy he had a fight with 8 years ago. He's facing he's coming back from an injury. It's all these things. As we know, where this gets overdone is the Olympic coverage, where they want to reach people who don't care about sports. And most people don't care about Olympic sports anyway, except for 2 weeks every 4 years. But what they do is they do all story and they kind of drain the sports out of it. And that doesn't work.
I think that's very profound. You're right. Because, again, thinking about Malcolm Gladwell's thing, 10,000 hours, that's what the experts have got. Look at what those sports guys are doing. You're right. What a sample size, 162 games you got to write up. There's 162 stories you got to tell all in 1 year. God, it doesn't take too many years at all till you hit 10,000 hours there. Not surprising they would have that. Yeah, exactly.
Okay, this is Freeform, a world that just might work. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Randy Olson, marine biologist turned filmmaker, author of Don't Be Such a Scientist, and Houston, We Have a Narrative, and founder of the Story Circles. And we talked about early in the interview, his narrative index predicted Trump's victory. You can learn more at randyolsonproductions.com. And that's exactly how you'd think it would be spelled, RandyOlson, productions.com, shiftingbaselines.org, shiftingbaselines.org, and scienceneedsstory.com. So you've referred to it several times, and at the risk of beating people over the head with it, I want to unwrap this and versus and, but therefore, a little more.
Yeah.
Okay, so how did you... how did you begin to see it, first of all?
Yeah, great question. I went to USC Cinema School, did the whole master's program 3 years in the mid-90s, had at least 5 writing courses, never heard any simple rules on story. 2011, I'd already written up in my book in 2009, Don't Be Such a Scientist, about my movie Flock of Dodos, and the whole story about we had a first version that was incredibly boring and didn't tell a story, and then it took 6 weeks of agonizing. We finally cracked the nut and found a story, and the rest was history. It premiered at Tribeca and ended up on Showtime. I didn't know really specifically what the dynamic was there. And then in the fall of 2011, watching this simple little Comedy Central documentary on the making of South Park, and Trey Parker tells about, he says, this is what we do each week. We have what we call our rule of replacing. We have the first draft, 40 pages. He said, I sit down and I go back through. And every time I see the word and, I ask myself, could I replace that with a but or a therefore? Every time you replace an and with a but or a therefore, the storytelling gets more interesting. I had never heard that. I called all my screenwriter friends, say, have you ever heard this? They all said no, but it makes total sense. That's at the core of The Hero's Journey from Joseph Campbell. I began researching it. My good friend Marty Kaplan at the Annenberg School of Communications pulled out this speech from Frank Danielle, who was the great, legendary screenwriting instructor. I was lucky enough to have his course the year before he passed away at USC, his script analysis course. And in this speech, he articulates it. He says, 1986, here's the problem. First drafts, we always fall into the dreaded and then structure. That's what you do with a first draft. In the revisions, we pull out those and thens and replace them with but and therefore. Those are the twists and turns that start to make it into a story. And it's those buts. Now you can jump to the neurophysiology. And in particular, there's a number of neurophysiologists now just starting to look at how the brain responds to narrative. Yuri Hassan at Princeton, I did a visit there 2 years ago, spent 2 hours with him in his lab. Tremendous guy. And he is doing some of the pioneering work, putting people in the MRI machine and looking at their brain activity of people watching movies that do tell a story and movies that don't tell a story. For the don't tell a story movies, it's just video of people walking randomly in a park. for the Do Tell story, he uses Hitchcock films. And you see huge difference in brain activity. Not at all surprising. You know, this is all fairly simple. But you give people a suspenseful story, the brain lights up. You give them a bunch of facts, and the brain goes numb. So that's at the core of it.
Okay, so so the and. One of the things, by the way, when I talk to folks, I also teach and coach people on storytelling. This is, as I said to you, this is a home game for both of us.
Yes.
obviously, sports is a big part of my brain. But I tell people, if your organization sets a goal and goes A, B, C, success, that is a great accomplishment. It is not a great story.
Right.
The conflict, the overcoming of obstacles is what draws your listener, your reader in. And the two examples I use is Superman without kryptonite is boring. And Shakespeare tells us the Montagues and the Capulets are engaged in a blood feud before we meet Romeo and Juliet. You put the stakes and the story, you know, and then you can tell the story. The thing that you said about brain science, what? Go a little bit more into that. What does that? Because when you started out, even though you're a scientist, my guess is you weren't looking at that. But over the years, as you've looked for confirmation or, you know, context for what you kind of intuitively figured out, brain science has borne you out.
Okay, first thing to say about brain science is a giant warning. There's a great article in The New Yorker in 2013 from Adam Gopnik called Mindless, in which he lays it out very clearly, which is the better brain scientists, when they get in there, they will say to you, the more that you learn about how the brain works, the more you realize we don't know. And I would say the same thing about narrative. The more you learn about narrative, the more you realize, God, we do not even understand the first thing. I mean, not the first thing, but there's so much to know about it. So Yuri Hassan at Princeton, from the beginning, 5-6 years ago, I began hounding him, and he always offers all these warnings. Look, fMRI is a very crude tool, so you got to be careful what you can infer from that. And so at this point, it's still very crude what they can infer on neurophysiology. But that said, it's just really clear that you could see that it's this force of contradiction that lights up the brain. So here's the important point, is to know that everything is underpinned by these three fundamental forces: agreement, contradiction, consequence.
Okay, let me slow you down on that one, because you've said it a few times, but even when I read it the first time, the good thing about reading is you read it and then you go, wait a minute. You know, you get a paragraph or two down and you go, what exactly was that? And you go back. In conversation often, podcasts and so on, that doesn't necessarily always happen. So when you say the first thing is agreement, what do you mean? How does it lay out in a story, and why is it important?
So it is the structure of a story as described by Joseph Campbell. Is a story is basically a circular journey. It begins in one place, ends in the same place, and along the way goes through three phases. The first phase he called the ordinary world. We begin a story without there being any conflict, no problems, no nothing. So think of a murder mystery. We're going to take you to a little town. Everything's wonderful, happy. And if we stay there too long without something happening, you're going to get bored and change the channel. But eventually something happens. We find a dead body. Now we enter into the second stage that Campbell called the special world, and now the brain is
so
lit up.
So agreement,
yes,
is, for me to cut in, agreement is, what you mean by agreement is that status quo.
Yes.
That world before the story takes off.
Yes.
That first 15 minutes of the movie when David Lynch shows us the sprinkler and stuff, you know, and everything is just so normal.
Yes, and happy and peaceful.
Now, there are some movies, as I tell people, where you're thrown into the crisis situation, but those are exceptions. Usually the setup, and if you think about it, those few words, once upon a time, are almost a way of saying that calm beginning.
Yes.
And then it takes off. Okay, so agreement doesn't necessarily mean you agree with everything. It means that there's kind of a place, a world, a status quo that we can all accept. And then,
if you bypass the agreement, go right to contradiction, you get everybody excited, but they're probably confused. They don't really quite know what's going on here. You know, oh, there's a crisis, yeah. Or you get into melodrama. And that's what we learned about in film school, was in the beginning with silent films, there were people like D.W. Griffith and other folks like that who said, this is how you make a movie. You've got to do this, and but therefore. And suddenly, there were these folks came along that made films called the serial queen melodramas, where they realized, you know what, you could just tie a woman down to the railroad train, have a train coming. We don't need to know who she is, how she got there, anything like that. We're engaged. The problem is serial queen melodramas, they're melodramas. They don't leave any impact on you. If you want to see a modern example of that in the last few months, perfect example is Dunkirk. What a great movie, but it's basically straight out of that tradition of the serial queen melodramas. If you look at the end, but therefore that movie, it's really fascinating. They go through the A and the B in the first minute. Literally, they come up with one screen, says Hitler had him surrounded, they were here, and the guy walks out on the beach and there's all these lines. That's your and your but, you know, they need to get back to Britain somehow. And the rest of the movie is all therefore. Therefore, they tried this, they did this, they did this.
Right,
this.
So if we're doing three-act structure, their first act was a minute.
Exactly.
Their second act was almost the whole thing.
That's it.
And their third act was the last 5 minutes because, right.
Yeah, it was all action and a great movie, but all the critiques of it, you know, what limited critique there was there's no character development. You're right. Yeah, exactly. And so it's an amusement park ride at that point, which is wonderful. It's just a different form of entertainment.
And what you're saying, I think, also, is that while it might work in a visceral medium like a movie, that if we're talking about your work, which is oriented scientists making a point, scientists convincing people, scientists persuading people, or take it broader, politicians, anyone who's attempting, then that setting up the jumping into the action and without setting up the context is more of a problem. See, what we're talking about is not just making movies. We're talking about communicating to persuade, communicating to motivate. And there you need that agreement first stage to from which to take off.
We're talking about everything because I've got a video coming out this fall from the American Association of Advancement of Science about our Story Circles training. And the first thing I'd say at the beginning of is narrative is everything. Three words. Narrative is everything. The deeper you learn about it. And, you know, one of the great books written on it is from Christopher Vogler called The Writer's Journey. And the third edition, in his preface, the second paragraph, he's got a great thing. And he says, the more I studied Joseph Campbell's hero's journey, which is the central narrative template, he said, the more I realized it's more than just this template. It is a handbook for life.
Mm.
And that's what happens. The deeper you get into this narrative stuff, you begin to see it's everywhere. And by the way, let me give you the ultimate ABT that we just last
now,
week.
Now, ABT, that's the and but therefore.
Just last week, talking to Jade Lovell, my Story Circles co-creator, we get to the end of the phone call, and just in a silly mood, she says, okay, well, you know, let's check in tomorrow. Call me maybe. And all of a sudden, there's a silence. I said, what are you doing? She said, well, I got to write a tweet. I got to write a tweet. So she tweets out the ultimate ABT. So that song from 2012, Carly Rae Jepsen,
right,
is the ultimate ABT. Think of the words. Hey, I just met you, and this is crazy, but here's my number, so call me maybe. And so is the simpler version of therefore. That's it. That's ABT. You see it everywhere. There's over a billion views of that music video on YouTube. It is ubiquitous. It's so powerful. And the power comes in the simplicity of this little template. That's the real attribute. Can we talk about the narrative index?
Well, wait.
Okay.
We were trying to lay out for them agreement.
Contradiction.
And but contradiction.
Yes.
So, I mean, and but therefore. So the but part is contradiction.
Yes.
Tell us more about that. So agreement is we've set the stage. You get to kind of get a feel for the person, their world, or the situation before the story takes off. And then contradiction happens.
That's it. And that's where the brain lights up. So if you don't get beyond the and part there at the beginning, then you're stuck in and mode, just giving us information. This is what happens with, not just with scientists, happens with anybody who's in love with their subject. They will just give you all these facts.
And they may be very fascinating facts.
Yes.
They may even be memorable facts.
To them.
Well, they may even be. You give
give
someone a crazy number that they'd never imagined, and it might stick in their mind, but
Absolutely.
Will it add up to anything
is what
we're talking about.
That's
it motivate? Will it persuade? Will it change behavior?
That's right. Exactly.
So what is contradiction?
Contradiction is what lights up the brain. So that's when you've got the problem. So these three elements, you know, you can also think of them. I mean, this is where you start to see the ubiquity of this. Comedians, basically, set up, twist, punchline. In the business world, situation, conflict, resolution. It is ubiquitous. In the world of debate and rhetoric, my good friend, Jerry Graff, who was in my movie Flock of Dodos, he and his wife, Kathy Berkenstein, published a book called They Say, I Say. It's getting close to 2 million copies sold. Almost any undergraduate you talk to in this country had to read that book for comparative literature, for rhetoric, for all these classes. Almost any science major that I talk to has never heard of the book. Why is this happening? Why do we have this gargantuan cultural divide when it shouldn't happen? Because this ABT is the common root for all of these sorts of things. So his book, They Say, I Say, he and I have had these long discussions. I pointed out to him, they say, I say, that's the and but. That's the agreement and contradiction. That's what they use as the central template for argumentation. This is the way you present a good argument. You begin not by saying, I'm here to tell you about that. You begin by saying, this is what other people have said. Now you get to the but. But what I say is this. And guess what? That's also what branding is, because narrative is everything. So you've got a corporation. Here's what all my competitors do. But here's what we do. This is what sets us apart. Narrative is everything.
So contradiction is a lot of it is what I was calling conflict.
Sure, but, sure. Yeah. That's another word for it, sort of. But contradiction is kind of broader.
But is it, if you think we're going along this path, we're in this world, we're in this day, as it looks like, this character is this guy, here's the piece of information that flips things around. It changes your mind about who he is or how this day is going to go or what this story is about. That's what it is, right? It's that thing that...
Let me give you another one of the ultimate examples of it. Once upon a time, we were a great and mighty nation, maybe in the 1950s or 60s, but in recent years, we've slipped in the world. Therefore, it's time for us to make America great again. That is how deep that guy's narrative intuition was from the very beginning. He came out of the gates with that slogan. Why weren't there any of these pundits looking at that, listening to that, alerting the public? This guy is tapping into a force that we've never seen before in mass politics like this. Again, Neil Postman would have warned of that. Michael Crichton would have sat up in his speech in 1999 that I am now editorializing on a great length, and we're coming out with the second edition of my book, Don't Be Such a Scientist, and I dissect that speech.
This is 1999, so remember that. That's 18 years ago.
Yes.
Michael Crichton, who, for those of you who don't know, Jurassic Park is his most famous franchise, but he came onto the scene as a Harvard med school student who, while being a med school student and being 6'9", that's irrelevant, but it helped the story. while being a med school student, wrote a book about what it was like to be a med school student or an intern, and the book was a bestseller. He is one of the few people who is a bona fide medical doctor and a killer writer.
No human has ever known more about the two worlds of science and the media than Michael Crichton. 1994, he's the only human to ever have simultaneously the top number one book, number one movie, number one TV show. So he knew more ever for a person with this science background. And
so in 1999, at the American Association for the Advancement of Science, he gives a talk.
He gives the keynote address, and that it's a blueprint for how to deal with the oncoming attacks on science. When you look at it, first off, if you look at the ratio buts to ands, that's my narrative index, it's sky high. He was arguing all the way through it. It was problem, solution. He's got four sections in there where he lays out these problems and offers up really clear-cut solutions. You know what the science world did? They didn't listen. That's the title of the new chapter I'm adding to my book, Don't Be Such a Scientist, is Don't Be Such a Poor Listener. That is the handicap. And I say not just that. Peter Kariva, who's currently the director of the Institute of the Environment at UCLA, reviewed Don't Be Such a Scientist in Science Magazine 2009. And his review said, nice book, but the guy failed to address the single biggest problem for scientists, which is their inability to listen. He was absolutely right. I'm now getting the second shot to do exactly what he recommended. And that's right.
Well, their response to your book proved his point. Right?
Exactly.
So then it got easier to do.
Yeah. That's the truth. What did he have to say? Oh, don't listen to him.
So now 10 years later or whatever it is, you go, boy, is he right. Okay, so do you want to, I think you can pretty quickly lay out, just because the Crichton talk means so much to you, what his four problems and his four solutions were.
They were things such as he recommended. A lot of it was about the power and the importance of the singular narrative. And going back to what we said about Hillary, you know, there she was on Meet the Press saying, oh, I don't have any one thing. It's a bunch of things. No, the singular narrative is essential. There's a book that came out in 2012, bestseller, called The One Thing, which is just a broader application of that. But more importantly, Robert McKee, you know, one of the gurus of screenwriting in Hollywood, his 1997 book Story is really kind of, you know, just one of the landmark works on story. And in there, he goes through what he calls arc plot, which is classical design that goes 4,000 years back to Gilgamesh. Already 4,000 years ago, our brains were formed this way. How in the world these people think they can come onto the scene de novo and come up with a communication strategy that does not yield to these age-old principles that our brains clearly are programmed with? It baffles me. And Hollywood is the place that for practical purposes over the past century, they have figured out the practical side of narrative. They haven't really wanted or needed to share it with the rest of society. That's part of what I'm trying to do is steal this knowledge in Hollywood and bring it out to the academic and the science world and say, look how much you could get if only we could cross this cultural divide. But that's the challenge.
So Crichton, one problem was they didn't focus enough. It wasn't singular. Two?
So one of his solutions was that the science world should come together, National Academy of Science, for example, and designate anointed spokespersons for different disciplines. There should be one voice for climate, and that never happened. So look who stood up to be the voice, Al Gore, you know, bless his heart, the best of his ability, but he didn't have the science background and the authority to do that.
If he'd been better at narrative, he'd be president.
That's true, too. These things all interweave together. So, yeah, that and, you know, he just had really, you can read the speech, specific recommendations. And again, they were never even acted on.
And as you say, one of your favorite lines from it is the Information Society, which is we are now. Now, although I would say Toffler was saying we were the Information Society, you know, 20 years before this, but we really are now. Crichton says we'll be dominated by those who know how to manipulate media. Of course. And let me see. You said one.
Well, and the other quote that I use from him is four words. Scientists don't understand media.
Right.
I've been at it now for 30 years, and I completely concur.
And you have an interesting theory, as I said, as to why scientists don't. And it comes even from your own experience.
Yeah. So the idea, we now know that the brain isn't finished with development until age 25. So that means that, you know, those last 10 years, all scientists by their teen years are headed off into this science world. The science world is vastly non-narrative. You're just bombarded with information and physical chemistry and, you know, geology, everything else like that. Facts, 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 facts. You go in the humanities track, you're reading hundreds of novels. And I hypothesize that has an effect on developing brains.
So you've got very smart people in both schools,
yes,
who are going to become your influences probably,
yes,
who are going to be the ones who write books and get on the air and stuff, and the science folks are taken out of narrative by the way they're schooled, by what is important to advance in their field, while the humanities folks, the social science folks, are dealing with narratives.
And the brain is forming neurons.
Yeah.
There's synaptic shaping and things like that that's happening in those years, 15 to 25.
So again, on your personal experience.
Yeah, well, I'm getting to that. So the consequence is that you've got a brain that is developmentally gone down a pathway. And I don't know that it's reversible. I don't know anybody's done any research testing this yet, but there's one experiment.
You've atrophied your narrative, right?
There was a brain transplant experiment conducted,
yes,
where a guy incubated his brain in that science world till age 38. Then he transplanted his brain from New Hampshire to Hollywood and went to film school. That guy is me. And today I am so much better at narrative. So I am the living proof you can get a lot better. I've written 3 books on this stuff. But that said, I can't tell stories with the sophistication, nuance, and subtlety that the great screenwriters of Hollywood can. I'll never be able to do that. I've accepted that. I went down a developmental pathway. I've done the best I could to kind of rectify that a bit. But there are these channels, these forks in the road that you hit.
Yeah. And one of the things you say, and you've said it in this interview, but I want you to emphasize it now, is that this isn't easy. And A, it isn't easy to do. B, it isn't easy to learn. So here you have this whole thing where what you're basically saying on your soapbox is get better at this, right? And yet, what happens often, and this is even my experience with clients when I talk about story, is a 3-hour workshop, a 1-day workshop.
That's what we're fighting.
The problem is,
yes,
that will show you the map, but then,
yes,
it's whisked away from you and you're back wandering the way you were the day before. So what you do in story circles is
exactly that.
You deal with that.
Yes, exactly. So we've split it into 2 things. The first thing is the 1-day intro thing to show you what story circles is. And then people that are serious enough about it sign on for story circles is 10 1-hour sessions stretched over 10 weeks. Right now, the National Park Service is running 6 of these simultaneously in Colorado, and we've run 26 so far, and it's great. It's a wonderful model.
So you said that fairly quickly, but what it happens is that first day, which is what people tend to want to sign up for in organizations, is one day where you tell us everything and we change our lives. What happens then is the people who take that one day form into 5-person groups,
yes,
and they will meet 10 times, yes, over the next whatever month,
yes,
2 months,
yes,
and in each of those hours that they meet, which I was surprised how short that is, but in each of those hours they are working it, practicing it, training their brains, both in doing it, hearing it, and giving feedback.
And the analogy is physical fitness.
Sure.
You can't expect to go to the gym, lift weights for one day, and go home buff. The same deal. You've got to work it out. But also, fascinatingly, those one-hour sessions, there's a video that plays for the 1 hour that cues them every 2 to 5 minutes. So nobody can dominate the thing. They got to keep moving on. And one of the fascinating things for scientists is they cannot practice perfectionism. And they are driven to do everything perfect. But in this thing, one of the rules is when the beep goes off, you've got to stop mid-sentence. And it drives them crazy. I want to finish my thought. No, you got, like I've been doing in this little hour right now. You see me, I got to finish my, that's still the science part of my brain speaking up. I got to get this exactly right. And watching scientists, because communication cannot afford the luxury of perfection. That's the fundamental divide. Research, you do need to be driven by. We got to get these numbers exactly right. We're not going to quit till we do that. But when it comes to communication, you got to keep moving on. It's about intuition. You got to get it roughly right and just keep going. And if you get caught up with, we're not going to release this press release till it's 100% perfect, you're going to just get outcompeted by everybody.
Okay, you got 2 minutes. That question that I asked of John Nichols, that question that you responded to, which is the Democrats, the progressives, the good guys, whatever, have to come up with a story more compelling than the past.
Yeah.
How do we go from here to 2018, from here to 2020, from here to getting through all this?
The fundamental challenge is time in our society now. Everybody feels they're too busy to do anything. The brightest person I've had the pleasure of working with so far in all the stuff that I do is Jade Lovell, my co-creator of Story Circles. She's a 31-year-old Australian woman. And a while back, she told me this little Australian expression, you don't want to be that person who's so busy digging with a spoon, you don't have time to put it down and pick up the shovel. That's what happened with Hillary Clinton's campaign. I managed to find my way to James Carville. He and I teamed up. He tried to convince the campaign to listen to me, and they were too busy. They were too busy digging with their little spoon, with their lack of narrative, to consider the idea of possibly picking up a shovel. That's what's got to happen. It's first off, you got to get away from this move on concept. It's not, you got to examine the past. You've got to learn from the past. You've got to learn from what happened with Hillary's campaign. And then you've got to make the time to understand that a little bit of time taken to pick up that shovel and start digging properly is going to work a lot better in the long term than sitting there and squirreling away on your treadmill with the little spoon, which is what's going on right now. There's just no
direction. So your answer to this question is not that you have a sense of what that story might be, of what that engaging narrative, compelling narrative that pulls us forward might be, but just that unless you stop and dig deeper and re-examine how you're communicating, you don't have a chance.
Yeah, I'll say my final statement on that. The best thing, one of the best things come out of my little friendship with James Carville is he connected me to a fellow named Dave Gold, who had a tremendous article in Politico in February this year about how the Democrats have become too obsessed with metrics. They got to get back to storytelling. And he talks about this great little analogy about the Christmas tree. The Christmas tree is the central narrative. That's what you hang all these issues on. But you've got to have that central narrative. You've got to figure out what's that message. Trump had it. He had it boiled down to one word, and that word is greatness. That is an aspirational word. Love it or hate it, he had those principles boiled down. The Democrats have yet to figure that out, and they've got to.
By the way, I'm going into the close here, but Obama,
yeah,
when he was reelected in 2012, his first interview, he said, I've got to get better at storytelling for my second term, and he got a little better. But even he saw it, but it's really hard to do. This is Free Forum, a world that just might work. The websites for Randy Olson's stuff is randyolsonproductions.com. That's Randy Olson, OLSON, productions, oneword.com. And Shifting Baselines, oneword.org, and ScienceNeedsStory.com, where he blogs. The books are Don't Be Such a Scientist and Houston, We Have a Narrative. Thank you, Randy Olson. Keep up the good work.
Thank you. This has been fun.
For this conversation and many other interviews, articles, transcripts of interviews, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net or aworldthatjustmightwork.com to the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcements of upcoming guests and issues, sign up at my site or email me at T-E-McNally, T-E-M-C-N-A-L-L-Y, at mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on iTunes. You can find years of podcasts at my site or at iTunes. Listen anytime, anywhere. Michael Lewis, Jeremy Scahill, Robert Reich, Van Jones, Connie Rice, Greg Boyle, Ariana Huffington. Thanks to G, my engineer, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all to you, my listeners, please share this podcast widely.